We have got Diana Nyad with us on the phone now. In the 70s, she was the greatest long-distance swimmer in the world. After setting a world record circling Manhattan, she became a prominent sports broadcaster. One record continually eluded her, becoming the first person to swim between Cuba and the Florida Keys without a shark cage. After four attempts in September 2013, at the age of 64, she did it, swimming for 53 hours across 110 miles. Her book, Find a Way, tells her incredible story of determination, courage, and strength. And there's a fabulous film called Nyad that came out a few months ago on Netflix, starring Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. Welcome to the show, Diana.
It's so great to be with you. How are you across the pond over there?
Oh, we're fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing well. You know, the Oscars were just the other night. And so we're kind of at the end of the magical journey of this movie. And, you know, it always surprises me. I've been telling my story on stage, did an off-Broadway show, as you mentioned in the book, kindly mentioned. Thank you. And, you know, I'm in front of corporate audiences all around the world. But I had forgotten the power of a motion picture. When you then have these, you know, storied performances by these storied actresses, you mentioned the incredible Annette Bening and the icon Jodie Foster playing our roles. Then you add in the music and the cinematography and all the things that put us under a movie spell. This movie is inspiring people all over the world. Bonnie and I are hearing from literally thousands of people from China, from the UK, from Chile, and people want to chase their own dreams and not give up on them. And nothing could mean more to me that my story is inspiring people to go out and live their biggest lives.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I mean, is that strange for you? I know you're used to doing that, as you said, with all the talks that you've done, but to get such a massive global response from people having watched the film, with people saying, oh my goodness, you and your story has just inspired me to go and live my life and reach for my dreams. I mean, what's that like for you?
You know, I say, honestly, it's nothing new. I think it is bigger. It's a bigger scale now because of the movie. But truthfully, back in the 70s and then again 10 years ago, when I did actually finish the swim and, you know, my team and I, you know, stood on that beach after so much intel, trying over 35 years, five different times, you know, each time an epic journey. I don't like to call them failures because they were journeys with all kinds of discovery. And so, you know, they were thrilling. Each one of the failures was a thrilling journey, you know, of all kinds of personal and scientific discovery. And the world knew, you know, not to exaggerate it too much, but after the swim in 2013, we did, similar to what we're doing now, we did hear from people all over the world. And what always surprises me is that it's a very eccentric enterprise, open water swimming, especially in these, you know, long distances. There are only a couple of us who do these. I don't know if you've heard of Sarah Thomas, but my goodness, Sarah Thomas swam four consecutive laps across the English Channel. She went over and back and over and back four times. Took her 54 hours also, similar to what it took me in that cold water. So she and I and only one other are doing these, you know, really eccentric long swims. But oddly enough, people read this story and they relate it. They, even though they can't relate to the eccentricities and the, you know, the hardships that happen out there, they relate to getting knocked down, whether they're fighting cancer, they're raising a disabled child, they're not finishing the novel they always promised themselves they would finish. They relate to you get knocked down and you know what? You get back up and you get knocked down again. It's part of life. We all suffer heartache. We all suffer even tragedy, but we get back up. And that's the human drive, the human spirit, is to try again and persist. And one day, if we do get back up, we get to that other shore, whatever your definition of your other shore is. So people relate to the story, even though they can't really relate to the, you know, the specific details of it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And with this swim particularly, obviously you've been doing lots of long distance swimming for many years. But when you wanted to undertake this particular journey, even your expedition leader and lifelong best friend, Bonnie, she wasn't sure. You know, she was kind of saying, no, Diana, you don't need to do this now. You know, you were 60 at the time. And was it to do with your age and kind of stage in life? Did that have something to do with you wanting to undertake this mission?
Well, no, it wasn't so much my age. It was my stage of life, is that I had been for 30 years. You know, I tried Cuba back in 1978, which is a long time ago. I was 28 years old, which is sort of the normal age that you do these sorts of things. And I didn't make it. You know, Mother Nature is on steroids out there. They call this swim the Mount Everest to the Earth's oceans. Lots of swims are tough. They're all tough, frankly, but this one's the toughest. And good swimmers, men, women, strong, young, fast, have been trying it and not making the crossing. And so there was that challenge to be the first. And I let it go for lots of reasons. Mainly, I needed to go make a living. So from age 30 to 60, I was, and I'm not going to complain ever about those years, I was traveling to Olympic Games, the Tour de France, the U.S. Tennis Championships, all that stuff, and following the best in the world pursue their excellence. And it was inspiring. It was fun. It was all that. But I began to feel that I was the spectator. I was always in the stands watching these people chase their dreams. I wasn't chasing my own big dreams anymore. I wasn't digging down to my potential. So it wasn't that I was 60. That wasn't freaking me out. It was that I was no longer happy being a spectator. And I decided the big goal, the holy grail, I wanted to go back and chase was that dream that was always deep in my heart. So that's what it was about, not so much that I was that age, you know?
Yeah. And was it difficult kind of going up against everybody else in your life? You know, everybody saying to you, oh, I don't think you should, and I wouldn't advise it. You know, how did you have the kind of confidence and strength to say to everybody, nope, I can do this. I'm going to do this.
Well, you know, I think the people who know me well know that there's no such, there's not going to be a good path toward trying to get me to not do something. So those voices drowned out pretty quickly. And I surely didn't care about the rest of the world, you know, weighing in as to whether I could do this or not. Frankly, it even wasn't a question of can you do it? Is that do you have the guts and do you have the smarts to put around a team around you who cares enough and who knows enough, you know, to put all their knowledge and all their commitment into this the same way I would? Because, you know, it looks like such a solitary endeavor, doesn't it? If you put a drone camera over our fleet as we came across for those 53 hours, you'd only see one set of arms coming out from the ocean, one left arm, one right arm, mine, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of times. But if you look over to the boat and you first see Bonnie, never ever moves from her position. She pees right over the side of the boat. She is not going to leave my sight. And she makes all the life and death decisions, whether it be about sharks, about deadly jellyfish, about my own sanity and beginning in continuing in case I'm flailing. And then we've got the navigator, the genius mathematical navigator. This is a very tough course to navigate. You're trying to go north and the mighty Gulf Stream is going three times your speed to the east. So you've got to navigate across that thing every 15 minutes, plotting a new course. We've got the medical team, the shark team, the jellyfish team, and all those people, all of us, we're in it. We're in it in a commitment deep. So we didn't care about the rest of the world or my other friends saying, oh, you're going to get hurt out there. You're going to die out there. You're never going to make it. Why keep doing it over and over again? We didn't give a fig about all of those opinions. Our team was in it, and we never lost sight of it, you know?
Yeah, amazing. And I'm glad you brought up jellyfish, because I was going to ask you about that. There were jellyfish. There were jellyfish that can do serious harm, never mind just a few stings. And you were harmed by jellyfish on a few of the trips, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, if you had a chance to interview the leading box jellyfish expert in the world, she's a premier scientist out of University of Hawaii, Dr. Angel Yanagihara, and she was on our team. We're very lucky to have her. She would, you know, give you a good primer on jellyfish all around the world, and there are thousands and thousands of species, many of them not too pleasant to be stung by, like the Portuguese man of war, for instance, and I've been stung by many of them. You know, in different oceans, and they hurt, and they can even cause a bit of anaphylactic shock, you know, affect your breathing. But nobody dies from any of those jellyfish, not directly, but the box jellyfish, and there are actually many species of those, so let's not get into the weeds on that. But the particular box jellyfish that swim in the waters between Cuba and Florida, closer to Cuba, most of them, they can be deadly. They can emit the most deadly, most potent venom on planet Earth. There's no spider, there's no snake, there's no animal that can kill as quickly and as efficiently as this tiny little box. It looks the size of a sugar cube, and it's actually beautiful, a translucent blue, but you don't see them when you're coming into a swarm of them. You get hit. And when I was hit in 2011, tentacles wrapped around the neck, around the bicep, across the back, I went into anaphylactic shock. They are paralyzing your spinal cord. You feel like you're actually being paralyzed. I was screaming out to body, body, help me, help me. I can't breathe. And I made it through. I don't know how I made it through. The doctors on board said that it no doubt had to be will, because there was no other way to stop, you know, the effects of that jellyfish. And I don't know how I made it through, but I didn't make that swim because of them, because now I was weak. And that current I told you about, now I wasn't sort of charging and powering north across that easterly flow of a current. I was being dragged to the east, and, you know, with a very slow and weak stroke. So again, Mother Nature, as I call it, won out on that swim again. But you get sensitized to that particular sting. It's called the Irukandji syndrome. If you're stung by that particular phyla of box, and if you're stung again, another occasion of it, the chances are good you'll die, because you don't get immune to them. You get more and more sensitized to them. And there are actually many cases of people who have died instantaneously. They haven't lived a minute or two after being stung. So I'm lucky I lived that night.
Incredible. And having gone through that experience, that didn't put you off? That didn't make you more nervous or thinking, should I really try again with this? I'm sure most people would have stopped at that point.
Well, it's a good point. I think, you know, an intelligent response would have been, I'm not going out there again. Most people who have lived through them say, I will never go in that water again. But, you know, what expeditions do, if you've tried to, let's say, snowshoe across Antarctica, and you come across bad weather and this and that and gear issues that could be improved, making sure you have bottled oxygen with you, whatever it is, you come back and you put the expedition together again, and you go out with better intel, better science. So once we made it through the box jellyfish, we didn't say stupidly, well, let's just go out exactly the way we did. We just designed a face mask. I work with a prostheticist who works with people who have been, you know, had face injuries in grenades or fires, and they're waiting for their graft surgery. And it took us 9 months, prototype after prototype, that I could swim and breathe through, but he made a very thin silicone mask that I could wear all the way over the nostrils, the mouth, the ears, everything, and got a suit that was suit made that was legal to the sport, no neoprene, no flotation device to it, got little booties, little silicone gloves, all of that very difficult to swim with. You're now, you know, burdened down. You can't wait till sunrise comes when the jellyfish measure no longer an issue, and you can take all that stuff off. But we wouldn't have gone back without that intelligent supervision by Dr. Yanagihara to get all of this skin coverage made. And so, yes, I wouldn't have gone back without it, but I wasn't going to not try and not come up with an innovation to get us through.
Yeah. And can you just, if possible, describe what it was like when you did eventually complete this and you landed on that beach with Bonnie, and there were all those crowds of people screaming and crying and marveling at your achievement? What did that feel like?
You know, this might sound odd, but it honestly wasn't a big ego moment of triumph. I still looking back at it, especially with the movie now, you know, I'm reminded of that moment quite a bit. So it wasn't a matter of, oh, we did it. We're the ones. We made history. It just wasn't like that. It was this deep, deep, deep pride that we never gave up, that we refused to quit, that there were four other times, you know, that we lay on the boats, just absolutely flat out exhausted and gassed in trying hard, but being beaten by Mother Nature each time. And we never, like Bonnie and I, would get up at 2 o'clock in the morning training in St. Martin and go out for a 14-hour swim. And there was never one day in all of those years that we got up that day and said, you know, let's, you know, forget about it. You know, who cares? It's our training schedule. Nobody's keeping us to it. It's us that has decided that 14 hours is what's needed. We can't leave any stone unturned to get ready for this. We got to get my mind and body. We've got to get the crew. We've got to get our working together, down to a science. And there was never a day where we said, you know what, let's go to the movies today. Let's take the day off. You know, we never did. And when I arrived on that beach, that's what I was filled with, that we refused to quit. And we refused to leave any stone, you know, that needed to be turned unturned. So that's what I still feel. And I think that if you go to bed every night and you say, there's nothing more I could have done with that day, there's not an ounce of regret I have about this day, yesterday, last week, all of my life, then what more can you give to your life?
Yeah. And were you able to honestly kind of embrace relaxation, both of the mind and body, after that day, to kind of think, wow, with all that hard work for years and years, we did it, you know, the team did it. Now I can rest up a bit and go to the movies if I want to.
Well, no, it wasn't like that at all. It was very high charged. I mean, immediately the world embraced the message, and immediately, even though the body did need, you know, recuperating and repairing. First of all, it's just me. I live on a high octane amount of energy, and it doesn't mean that I don't sit down and watch a movie. It doesn't mean that I don't go to the beach with my dogs and look out at the horizon and watch them happy and playing. It's not like I'm driven towards success all the time, but I must say that I'm not one that just sits around. You know, I don't do much, just pure relaxation. And after that swim, the world wanted to embrace the message. They wanted to embrace their own dreams. And I was there for them for those 5 or 6 years. Right the day after that swim, I started traveling and speaking and meeting people and holding them in my arms. A man I met right after the swim had just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and already in just a very few weeks, he was seeing his body decline, and he knew it was never going to turn around and go in the other direction. But we cried together, and he said, "You have shown me, though, that I'm going to try to be my best self no matter what, even though this Parkinson's has got me by the short hairs now." So I didn't want to miss that opportunity. You know, I just don't want to miss my life by lying around and doing nothing. It's just not me.
Yeah. Wow, that's inspiring. Just hearing you say that is so inspiring for so many people, because a lot of people do kind of sit around not doing a lot, and that could be interpreted as kind of wasting their lives. Is it frustrating for you when you come across people that kind of don't really have any ambition or drive to do much? I'm not talking about the incredible things that you've done, but just general day-to-day getting up off their butts and really living their lives. Because there are people out there that just think, oh, can't really be bothered. Let's just see what's on telly.
No, you know, I have no judgment. Everybody has this, as Mary Oliver, the poet, put it, one wild and precious life. And it's absolutely up to each individual what they do with their lives. I'm just saying that when people come to me and say, I've got a dream, but I've got this in the way, and I can't raise the funds for it. I can't quit my job to chase it. Then I'm there for them. I think I'm there for people who already feel something. They want to live a wild and precious life. But I'm not here to judge people who, live a more laissez-faire life. I have a friend who dropped out. She lives up in the mountains of Oregon. She just goes out every day and picks mushrooms and looks up at the blue sky and takes it in. Am I going to say that's not a valuable life? No. I'm not going to tell her to quit and go over to England and get into Oxford and study biochemistry. It's not up to me, everybody. But all I know is it's a one way street. You never get to do this day again. And when you get to the end, whether it's at age 78 or 88 or 98, you don't get to go back and do any of it again. So I'm just here, to hopefully inspire people and be with people who really don't want to get to the end with regrets.
Yeah. 100%. And just your comments briefly on the film. I assume you were heavily involved in the film and Annette Bening's interpretation of you. Were you kind of pleased how it all went?
Well, there's a reason that a lot of biopics are done on people who have already dead, because they're no longer around to grouse about how the film's being made and how it's being interpreted. I spent a lot of time with Annette, as Bonnie did with Jodie Foster. And then the four of us spent a lot of time for the months leading up to their shooting. And I think, it wasn't so facile as they're just, looking to see how we hold our coffee cups. They're really getting down to the essence of who we are. And of course, they read my book and they saw the TED Talks and they did their research, but they spent time with us to get our spirit. And so I think it was important to them. And the producers and directors were very respectful of me and of Bonnie, the writer as well, of learning, who we are, why we did this thing, how we did it, what it was all about, what it meant to us. But when it came down to actual contractual control, they're very careful. And I think almost all biopics are the same, like the Bernstein family and the making of Maestro. They're very, the producers of these films are very careful to let you know that it's their movie and it's going to be their interpretation of what they think makes a good movie. And they do not allow you to have any direct, sort of dictatorial say in it. So I was consulted a lot, but the consulting stopped at that word. I wasn't allowed to dictate what they would do with it. And in the end, you and I could, if we sat down and had a long coffee, I could tell you things that weren't quite accurate to me, my person in the movie. And on the other hand, does that really matter? This movie is inspiring people, as I said before, literally all over the world. It's a tribute to my deep friendship with Bonnie and what friendship means. People come up to me all the time now and they say, I have a Bonnie. And that, what could mean more that people get what it means to have a Bonnie? So if people get that you've got to have grit, that you just can't quit, even if you're hit hard, and you're in pain, but you decide to get back up. All those things are so crucial. And I'm so proud of this film and what it delivers in those big messages.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, if people haven't seen it, they must. It's on Netflix. It's called Naiad. And also they can pick up a copy of your book, Find a Way, from our website, tre.radio. Diana Naiad, thank you so much for joining us on Talk Radio Europe.
It's been my pleasure. Have a great day. Cheerio, as they say.
Cheerio.
Bye.
Bye-bye.